Audiobook, partly, of Book on Arago. Intro. A woman relative screamed and ran out of the room. The others stood transfixed. The dying woman lay quietly, unperturbed, as he continued to plunge and jab the blade mercilessly. Then he removed the blade, forced his hand into the opening, savagely twisting his wrist as he did so. In a matter of seconds he withdrew his hand, yanking out an enormous bloody uterine tumor, the size of a small grapefruit. He crossed to the kitchen, dropped the knife and the ugly flesh into the sink, and then sank down on a chair beside it. And when the dying woman he had operated on rallied and was able to return to normal life, the pressure to help those who were begging for treatment became irresistible. One morning when nearly 100 people gathered outside his door, Arago opened it and let them come in, one by one. ATM. Arago ATM's healings were witnessed by doctors, recorded on film, scientifically authenticated. They really happened. Here is John G. Fuller ATM's meticulously researched, painstakingly documented account of the phenomenon that has confounded modern medicine. John G. Fuller, Arago, Surgeon of the Rusty Knife, afterword by Henry K. Puharich, M.D. Copyright John G. Fuller, 1974. More than 50 years ago. This book is sold subject to the condition that it shall not, by way of trade or otherwise, be lent, resold, hired out or otherwise circulated without the publisher ATM's prior consent in any form of binding or cover other than that in which it is published and without a similar condition including this condition being imposed on the subsequent purchaser. This book is published at a net price and is supplied subject to the Publishers Association standard conditions of sale registered under the Restrictive Trade Practices Act, 1956. Author ATM's note. In this story, so strange, so incredible, there are undisputed facts, facts that cannot be denied, cannot be altered even by the most obdurate skeptic. It is an established fact that Arago, the peasant Brazilian surgeon healer, could cut through the flesh and viscera with an unclean kitchen or pocket knife and there would be no pain, no hemostasis at the tying off of blood vessels and no need for stitches. It is a fact that he could stop the flow of blood with a sharp verbal command. It is a fact that there would be no ensuing infection, even though no antisepsis was used. It is a fact that he could write swiftly some of the most sophisticated prescriptions in modern pharmacology, yet he never went beyond third grade and never studied the subject. It is a fact that he could almost instantly make clear, accurate, and confirmable diagnoses or blood pressure readings with scarcely a glance at the patient. It is a fact that both Brazilian and American doctors have verified Arago ATM's healings and have taken explicit color motion pictures of his work and operations. It is a fact that Arago treated over 300 patients a day for nearly two decades and never charged for his services. It is a fact that among his patients were leading executives, statesmen, lawyers, scientists, doctors, aristocrats from many countries, as well as the poor and desolate. It is a fact that Brazil ATM's former president, Juscelino Kubitschek, the creator of the capital city of Brasilia and himself a physician, brought his daughter to Arago for successful treatment. It is a fact that Arago brought about medically confirmed cures in cases of cancer and other fatal diseases that had been given up as hopeless by leading doctors and hospitals in some of the most advanced countries in the Western world. But none of these facts, all carefully brought together and examined, can add up to an explanation. And it is for this reason that this story is so difficult to write. The question keeps repeating itself in my mind, how am I going to write this story so that the reader will believe it, especially when I had so much trouble believing it myself until completing the research in Brazil? Any understanding of the events here must arise from an understanding of the atmosphere and culture of Brazil itself. It is a country of contrasts, a country of vast wilderness and of bristling modern cities. S.A. Tilda Pando Paulo, for instance, is a city of nearly 8 million, approximately twice as large as Chicago or Los Angeles. Belo Horizonte, in the plateau region northwest of Rio, is larger than Baltimore, Washington, or San Francisco. Yet it is a city little known to most people in the United States. Brazil is larger in area than the continental United States. Its population ranges from highly sophisticated intellectuals and scientists to primitive Amazon Indians. Most important to understand in this story is the prevalence in Brazil of a willingness to accept paraphysical happenings as basic realities. This willingness cuts across all social and economic lines. In fact, it almost seems that the more sophisticated and educated the group, the more likelihood there is of acceptance of a philosophy known as Cartesianism, springing from the writings of a 19th century French mystic known as Alain Kardec, a French professor whose real name was Denis Drivail. The Cartesists flatly believe in the rational reality of the spirit world, and in communication with and effective use of it. They believe in reincarnation. The Cartesists are known as intellectual aspiritists, TM, who do not believe in ritual and paganism. They meet quietly, most often in private homes, and embrace most of the tenets of Christianity. They believe, however, that they can draw on the power and knowledge of the spirit world through mediums who are carefully trained for this purpose. Some Kardec theorists who are knowledgeable about every aspect of Freudian theory believe that a possession, a TM, is a phenomenon that has been overlooked in the headlong development of modern psychotherapy, and that there is rational and viable evidence that many cases of psychosis from schizophrenia to dementia praecox could be ascribed to the phenomenon of a possession, a TM, by an alleged spirit that refuses to accept the fact that he or she is dead. The spirit, whether good or bad, is said to be incorporated a TM in the living body of a receptive person. 6. This idea is mostly rejected by the modern pragmatic mind, and a possession a TM has been summarily dismissed by medical science without either positive or negative evidence being examined until recently. Catholicism has long struggled with the problem, but remains ambivalent about it. A possession a TM is a very heady concept for the materialistic mind to accept or cope with. Modern parapsychology is beginning to re-examine the concept, although gingerly. There are other signs on the horizon that foreshadow a reawakening of interest in this area, not only in Brazil but also in the United States. It may or may not have been an accident that the novel The Exorcist rode the bestseller lists for so many months. Many people do not realize that this story was based on an actual documented case of possession in the archives of the Catholic Church, and that there are many recorded cases similar to it. Any serious exploration into this field in the United States is bound to raise eyebrows. There are many good reasons why it should. Charlatans and irresponsible writers have created so much static and high noise level, without any reliable documentation, that they defeat their own cause. Anyone exploring a strange phenomenon has to assume that the burden of proof lies on his shoulders. The more strange it is, the greater the documentation needed, and the greater the need for understatement. No other so-called a psychic surgeon TM in Brazil or the world has been confirmed and documented as thoroughly as Arago. Many reports have come from the Philippines about feats of surgery by untutored and untrained psychics there, but there has been a constant exposure of trickery in their work. Further, their lack of cooperation with medical researchers has made their case untenable. Arago was unique. He cooperated in every possible way with medical science in the hope that he could discover for himself the strange mechanism that created his inexplicable powers. He defies classification. What he did was vividly real. How he did it remains a mystery and a challenge for science. John G. Fuller, Westport, Connecticut. Chapter 1. It was almost dark as the Volkswagen microbus twisted along the Serpentine Road from Rio de Janeiro, 400 kilometers to the south, toward the village of Congonhas do Campo. The green mountains, rolling like a rumpled billiard table, had turned to a purple-gray as the hot Brazilian sun deserted them. The Rio Highway, known as BR-3, favored the gentlest possible route through this mining country, where black gold and iron had magnetized the attention of European and North American exploiters since Brazil's earliest colonial days. At twilight, the bare emerald surface of the treeless mountains changes from stunning brilliance to an ominous aura that historically has engendered myths and legends. Inside the microbus were four men, two interpreters, university students from the University of Rio de Janeiro, and two Americans of widely divergent backgrounds. Henry Belk, a rangy, congenial, 50-ish southerner from North Carolina who was both a successful businessman and an intellectual adventurer, had been at the wheel for nearly 10 hours, dodging over exuberant Brazilian drivers and maneuvering around the precipitous hairpin turns with considerable skill. Beside him was Dr. Henry K. Puharich, he rarely used his given name, and Raya, with a medical degree from Northwestern University and a specialty in bioengineering. He further had a proclivity for trying to fuse and consolidate his extensive scientific background with little understood psychic phenomena. An alert and articulate man in his 40s, he had been drawn together with Belk in an exploration of the unusual faculties of Peter Hercos, the medium whose ESP prowess had engendered considerable attention among both scientists and law enforcement agencies when he located missing persons and solved some knotty cases by clairvoyance. But it was not Hercos they were seeking out in these sweeping plateau highlands of Brazil. It was a man called Zarrigo, a dynamic Brazilian of peasant stock whose fame, 15, had reached the ears of Belk in his own explorations of the paranormal. Belk had set up an extensive research foundation for just such inquiries. He had persuaded Puharich to join him in an investigation of Arrigo, whose medical cures kept him on the front pages of Brazilian newspapers and whose exploits were rumored to border on the miraculous. By the time dark had closed in, the bus still had not reached Congonhas do Campo, and it was after 10 before they stumbled on the rather shabby little town of Conselheiral Afuaiat, a railroad mining village on the plateau, 20 kilometers short of their target. A hotel in the village looked black and uninviting, and they decided to press on, late as it was, under the peculiarly brilliant stars that hung like lamps over the mountains, now chilled by the darkness. Tired from the long drive, Puharich found himself wondering just what he was doing in this offbeat part of the world. He had reached that point in the expedition where he wondered whether he should ever have set out on it. Belk was finding his enthusiasm waning, too, although neither had yet cast eyes on the object of their inquiry, the man known as Arrigo. They had little enough to go on, but the clues were intriguing. In Rio, Dr. Lauro Neiva, a doctor who had studied medicine in the United States, had vouched for the reality of Zarrigo TMS healings, but told them that a major investigation was necessary to verify the flood of stories that were emanating from the village of Congonhas. He had insisted that Arrigo had to be seen to be believed, that no amount of description could project the power and force of the man. They had also encountered John Lawrence in Rio, a systems engineer in the TMS SPADE program, and an executive who had served on the advisory committee in setting up NASA. Lawrence had been discovering that not only Arrigo was worthy of a full-scale investigation, but the entire Brazilian healing scene, with its unorthodox use of the paranormal in both surgery and medicine. These leads, among others, tempered the exhaustion 16 from the long drive and held the promise of an illuminating discovery, if indeed the facts did check out. When the microbus finally did limp into the narrow, twisting streets of Congonhas late on the night of August 21, 1963, the search for bed and shelter overrode any thought of scientific discovery. In the dark, the surpassing beauty of the little plateau town was nowhere evident. All they could find was a small, scrubby pension on a cobbled street. But at least there was a cubicle and bed for each, and the anticipation of encountering a strange unknown quantity on the following day. Congonhas do Campo sits in a crease of the plateau mountains of the state of Minas Gerais. Except when the towering thunderheads split open and release a cascade of water, when rivers become swollen and angry, the climate is fresh and stimulating. Nearly half of the world TMS diamonds came from Minas Gerais in colonial times. Diamonds and semi-precious stones match the lure of its rich iron ore today. With the mountains rimming Congonhas, the sun comes up later and goes down earlier, leaving ample room for the atmosphere of mysticism that abounds all through Minas Gerais. Out of this mysticism grew the works of sculpture which today draw visitors to Congonhas from over the world. Are the 12 biblical prophets of Eliagadano. Exquisitely carved from soapstone in the 18th century, they stand like life-size sentinels surrounding the high terrace of the Church of Bom Jesus, overlooking the village and gazing outward over sweeping distant vistas. Eliagadano had been crippled with leprosy, but he had chipped away at the stone with tools strapped to his withered stumps of arms. Yet the precision of his works is magnificent and emotionally overpowering. Some call them minor miracles. Over 60 life-size figures of Christ and the crucifixion, carved from cedar, are housed in small chapels in the hilly garden of the church. Both the wooden and stone statues are so vivid and lifelike that they have a profound effect on villagers and tourists. On the bright, newly washed morning that followed their 17, long trip, Belk and Puharich and their interpreters rose with the sun and prepared to find the strange peasants that had brought them so many miles. Reports had been that Arago began work early. They were directed to the narrow cobblestone street called Rue Amaréchal Floriano, barely wide enough for a car to squeeze by. The town was just beginning to stir. A gaucho passed them on horseback, a riderless mule behind him. The man nodded in a friendly Brazilian way and continued on with only a casual backward glance at the two Americans. They found Arago at EMS Small A Clinic at EM on a corner, a modest, undistinguished one-story cement building. Already over 50 people were waiting expectantly in the street, although the clinic had not opened yet. The town was bisected by a small, muddy river, where swarms of vultures were feasting on some indiscernible carrion. Beside it, the visitors found an open restaurant, not particularly appetizing, but serviceable in the face of morning hunger. Having reached their destination after so long and arduous a trip, Belk and Puharich were less than elated. Doubts continued to set in. They were to be joined that afternoon by Jorge Rini, a journalist and documentary film producer from S.A. Tilda Pando Paolo, who had been among the first to bring Arago to the attention of the country. Rini, who was convinced of the validity of Arago at EMS work from his former visits to Congonhas, was most eager to establish objective scientific verification. He had color motion pictures of several of the major operations Arago had performed. These films were of extreme importance to Belk and Puharich at EMS investigation, because they had learned on arrival in Brazil that both the Brazilian Medical Society and the Catholic Church were pressing a lawsuit against Arago not only for the illegal practice of medicine but for witchcraft as well. Reports were that Arago was being extremely cautious about major surgery in the face of the legal charges. Rini, who was highly recommended to the Americans as a stable and level-headed journalist, had another qualification of major interest. His wife had been cured of crippling arthritis by Arago, his daughter of leukemia. He would, they learned, 18, be able to document this in great detail. By 7 in the morning there were nearly 200 people in the streets as the doors to the strange clinic, a dilapidated former church, were opened. An old blind man, propping himself up with his cane, a slender, aristocratic woman of about 40, in a flowered print dress, a pale, thin man with an enormous goiter, a one child in a wheelchair, a stout, busty black woman, holding her eyes with a handkerchief. They and the multitude behind them stood mutely in the line that now wound around the corner and all along the cobblestones of Rue Amaréchal Floriano. Most were from other parts of Brazil or South America, having come by bus or train or auto. The word had obviously gone around the village that the research team had arrived, although the Americans had not announced their visit in advance. As the four men approached the door, they were unceremoniously waved ahead of the patients into their clinic by a soft-spoken black man named Altimiro. Inside was a powerful, barrel-chested man in a dark sport shirt and slacks, and muddy shoes. He had a thick black mustache, a generous crop of equally black hair, a bronze face, and striking, penetrating eyes. He appeared unshaven and rustic. There was little need to ask who this was. It was Arago. He greeted them warmly, as if he already knew where they were from and why they were here. Far from mystical in appearance, he looked like a cross between a congenial truck driver and a local politician, which Puharich later learned was one of Arrigo Atm's consummate ambitions. In this Arrigo was hampered, however. He had never gone beyond third grade. They could stay and observe as long as they wished, he told Belk and Puharich through the interpreters, and were free to interview any of the patients and to ask any questions. In his early 40s, Arrigo seemed so burly, normal, and friendly that the Americans were taken slightly aback. After the initial shock, they leaned against the rough plaster wall and watched the patients move hesitatingly into the building, single file. Inside the door was a large, barn-like room with pale lime, green plaster walls and a tile floor of geometric black and white design. There were rough wooden benches around the walls, and several rows in the center of the room, arranged like church pews. Lonely and despondent, the group moved silently to the wormy benches, then lined themselves against the wall when the benches were filled. The room, dark and musty, and now crowded, was framed by several doorways. One led to a room with two or three cots in it. It was unoccupied. Another led to the cubicle where Arrigo worked. It held only a chair and a crude wooden table. Behind them was a picture of Christ, with a crucifix on the wall nearby. On the walls also were several crude, hand-printed signs. A large one, stroked with black crayon letters on a crumpled piece of brown paper, read, "Think and observe the other CTM, silence, faith and devotion." Smaller signs beneath it read, "Donya TMT, lean against the wall, think of Jesus, wait in an orderly manner." To Puharich, there was something strange and unreal about the atmosphere, almost as if he were watching a scene from Twilight Zone. There seemed to be a mood of quiet chaos in the rooms, an air of both expectancy and despair. By now, the interpreters had passed along the news that the gossip in the line had been all about the Americano doctor at TM who was here to watch. Several patients glanced uneasily in Puharich TMS and Belka TMS direction. In a few moments, Arrigo stepped to the center of the room. He spoke Portuguese in a rough, peasant accent. Softly, the interpreters translated what he said. It was not he, Arrigo told the gathering, but Jesus who brought about the cures. He said that he knew the anguish 20, of the paralytics and the despair of the ill. He pointed out that each man has his own religion and that he did not want to know the conviction of any man. All religions are good at TM, he said. Is this not true? ATM, there was a murmur of agreement. Then he went on to denounce the fetishes and incantations of Quimbanda, one of Brazil TM's primitive ritualistic sects. This was not a true religion, he told them, and could never be considered as such. Whatever he was, the husky, dark-haired Arrigo was firm and positive in his convictions, with a unique magnetism. In the next moment, he was off on a sustained tirade against smoking and alcohol. There was no ambiguity in his disdain of these practices. He spoke gruffly, angrily, revealing several quirks and prejudices as he did so. Drinking and gambling, he was saying, were the curse of men, along with lying and cheating. But for women, smoking was the heinous crime sufficient, perhaps, to justify a husband taking another woman. Then, in his strange, mercurial way, he joked with the people for a moment. Abruptly he became serious again as he led them in a recital of the Lord at TMS prayer. As he did so, the conviction that they had come to Congonhas on a wild goose chase grew in the minds of both Belk and Puharich. As moving and poignant as the scene was up to this moment, it was hardly a jump-off a point for a scientific investigation. Arrigo, his hands clasped and head lifted as he said the prayer, seemed more a small-town preacher at a tent meeting in the Bible Belt than a phenomenon that had excited so much interest in all of Brazil and most of South America. The prayer finished, Arrigo turned quickly and went into his cubicle, closing the door after him. Some of the patients shifted uneasily on the benches, others went into whispered conversations. two assistants, youthful dark-skinned girls, moved about the room quietly checking the order in which the patients would line up along the wall, facing them toward the small barren room where Arrigo would begin his consultations at his table. In a corner of the large outside room, a soft-spoken male 21, assistant with soft, sad eyes sat at an ancient typewriter, waiting for the morning OTMS activities to start. His function was not yet clear to the Americans. Nor did they know quite what to expect as far as Arrigo was concerned. He had entered the small room alone. But in moments, he came back out of it, briskly. He seemed to be totally a different person. He held his head high, almost arrogantly, his eyes, very burning and penetrating before he entered the room, were now radiantly piercing, but at the same time withdrawn, almost as if they were out of focus. They glistened in the dim light of the room. Now he spoke sharply, like a Prussian officer. The interpreters noted a thick German accent in his Portuguese, harsh and guttural. Arrigo pointed to another sign on the wall, which read, "No one will be taken care of today who has taken any alcoholic drink. Come back tomorrow without anything to drink." Then, imperiously, he walked over to Puharich and Belk. "Hey, come here, TM," he said, and led them through the now open door of his treatment room. The attendants moved the line of patients up, along the wall of the big room and into the smaller one, where the first dozen patients took their positions. Arrigo summarily ordered the two Americans to stand by the table. "A, there is nothing to hide here, TM," he said. "A, I am happy to have you watch. I must assure you that what I do is safe and that the people who are ill become well, TM." He said this with the great confidence of a Prussian general, quite out of character with his former rural bearing. Suddenly and without ceremony, he roughly took the first man in line, an elderly, well-dressed gentleman in an impeccable grey sharkskin suit, firmly grasped his shoulders, and held him against the wall, directly under the sign "Think of Jesus." Puharich, standing next to the man, was startled by the action, wondered what to expect next. Then, without a word, Arrigo picked up a 4-inch stainless steel paring knife with a cocobolo wood handle, and literally plunged it into the man's TMS left eye, under the lid and deep into the eye socket. In spite of his years of medical practice and experience, 22, Puharich was shocked and stunned. He was even more so when Arrigo began violently scraping the knife between the ocular globe and the inside of the lid, pressing up into the sinus area with uninhibited force. The man was wide awake, fully conscious, and showed no fear whatever. He did not move or flinch. A woman in the background screamed. Another fainted. Then Arrigo levered the eye so that it extruded from the socket. The patient, still utterly calm, seemed bothered by only one thing, a fly that had landed on his cheek. At the moment his eye was literally tilted out of its socket, he calmly brushed the fly away from his cheek. As he made these motions, Arrigo hardly looked at his subject, and at one point turned away to address an assistant while his hand continued to scrape and plunge without let-up. In another moment, he turned away from the patient completely, letting the knife dangle half out of the eye. Then he turned abruptly to Puharich and asked him to place his finger on the eyelid, so that he could feel the point of the knife under the skin. By this time, Puharich was almost in a state of shock, but he did so, clearly feeling the point of the knife through the skin. Quickly, Puharich asked one of the interpreters to ask the patient what he felt. The patient spoke calmly and without excitement, merely stating that although he was well aware of the knife, he felt no pain or discomfort. Arrigo, still speaking in a harsh German accent, told them that he often used this technique as either a diagnostic tool or for eye operations. To Puharich, this violated every medical technique he had known in his 20 years of experience since studying medicine at Northwestern. For Belk, who had studied psychology at Duke, the procedure was simply inconceivable. He felt limp and slightly nauseated. Within a few moments, Arrigo withdrew the paring knife from the eye, bringing out with it a smear of pus on the point. He noted it with satisfaction, then unceremoniously wiped the knife on his sport shirt and dismissed the patient. "You will be well, my friend A.T.M., he said. Then he called the next patient. The entire A examination at TM had taken less than a minute.